You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Afternoon. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's very special lunchtime talk. It's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speakers. I'll do it swiftly as I need no real introduction. On my far right is Tim Bale. He's Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, and he's author of a splendid new book on the Miliband leadership, a five-year mission, the Labour Party under Ed Miliband. Janan Ganesh is political columnist for the FT. He was previously political correspondent for The Economist for 5 years, and he authored the authoritative biography of George Osborne. And Miranda Green is a contributing editor at Newsweek magazine and a regular pundit on BBC political shows, and she was previously Paddy Ashdown's press secretary. We're incredibly lucky to have these expert commentators with us today to help us get to grips with the coming election. Each of them is insightful, eloquent and utterly charming. So I've asked each of them to speak for about 7 minutes or so. Tim will concentrate on Labour, Miranda on the Lib Dems and Janan on the Conservatives. And they'll outline their analysis of where the election is and also where the post-election landscape might head. So let's begin. And I'm going to hand over to Janan to give us his thoughts up front. Janan.
Well, thanks for inviting me and thanks for coming. This election, you'll be told that this election is the closest and most important for a generation. And I think that is only half correct. I don't think it's the most important. I think 2010 was more important because it determined what our fiscal policy was going to be at a time when our deficit was 11% of GDP and the markets, at least on the continent, were a little bit skittish. Whereas this election determines what our fiscal policy is going to be at a time when the deficit is, whatever, 5% of GDP and the markets are much more relaxed. So it matters hugely as an election, but I think it's less of a fork in the road than 2010 was. But it is the closest election since 1974, when we had two in the same year. And the way I would put it is that it's the first election in my lifetime where 3 weeks out we don't know who's going to win. Now, some of you will cite 1992 as another example, but in 1992, 3 weeks out, we knew Labour were going to win. We were wrong, but we had someone on this panel 23 years ago at this time would have hazarded a guess in a way that none of us really can, and it seemed that Labour would win. So it's the closest election since 1974. And the question that I keep getting asked from people looking at Britain from the outside, whether they're foreign investors or foreign readers emailing me, is why is the election as close as it is? From their perspective, not from mine, but from their perspective, they see a prime minister who is reasonably respected, an economy which is in its third year of recovery, low unemployment, low inflation, and the rest of it. Surely this adds up to a pretty comfortable victory for the incumbents. And I think the analytic mistake that they make and that the Conservative Party makes is assuming that there are only two fundamentals in politics, leadership and the economy. And if that were true, then the election would already be over. The Conservatives would be heading for an overall majority. But there is a third fundamental, which is this thing that we've come to call your party's brand or reputation. And brand is a smarmy-sounding word for something that's actually quite serious and substantial and shifts a lot of votes. So how is your party perceived in the country? Do people identify with its values or its perceived values? Do they think it's on their side and populated by people who are like them? And on that score, Labour are insurmountably ahead, and the Conservatives have the same as bad a problem of brand toxicity as they've had for the past 20 years. So this is not an election between a popular leader with strong economic credentials versus an unpopular leader with bad economic credentials. It's a contest between an unpopular party with a popular leader and strong economic credentials versus a popular party with an unpopular leader and weak economic credentials. So the score is not 2-0, it's 2-1. And that explains why the election is much closer than I think a lay observer from abroad might assume it should be. And this question of brands sort of feeds into what happens post-election, not in the subsequent weeks, but in the subsequent years. The single biggest challenge for the Conservative Party is how do they finally fix this radioactive reputation they have in the north of England, or at least the northern cities of England, Scotland, Wales, even London now, where it's seen as countercultural to vote Tory. And I've got suggestions which we can thrash out later on, but I'll close by just saying one thing, which is that I have quite a reductionist view of politics, which is that the only thing that ever works, that really shifts votes and on a lasting basis, is when you surprise people, when you say things that are counter to what they expect you as a party to say. And you can surprise people in various ways. You can choose a leader who is very unlike your party. I think Labour in 94, a northern Celtic working class party, choosing a guy who was technically northern but sounded southern, barrister, very could have plausibly been a sort of one nation Tory in his outward demeanour, was an incredibly potent thing to do. I think it just gave them 4 points extra in the polls without, even before he turned out to be as good as he was as a skilled politician. Or, leadership is one way you can surprise people. Or the other thing is policy, coming up with shockingly counterintuitive policies. And I always wonder what would have happened in recent years had the Conservatives proposed a higher inheritance tax and used the money to spend more on the NHS or cut the standard rate of income tax or build more houses or whatever. Something that absolutely grabs people by the lapels and says, we are not who you think we are, we're this. So the reason this election is as close as it is also linked to the Conservatives' biggest mission between 2015 and 2020, which is not how do you cobble together a coalition or any of the technical stuff we'll discuss, but how do you get to a stage where people with right-of-centre views in Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow do not regard it as perverse to vote for your party?
Great. Thank you, Justin.
So some early applause and on to Miranda.
Janann does a brilliant line in arguing for why boredom in politics and keeping things simple is a good idea. And when I've just read one of Janann's columns, I agree with him. And then I have to battle my own boredom. And then I disagree with him all over again. It seems to me this idea of is it a real fork in the road or not? It's very, very interesting, actually, because certainly I would agree that, in terms of fiscal policy, that's now set. And the Labour Party, even at their manifesto launch this week, was having to make huge efforts to reassure people that they had also got the message on fiscal rectitude. But actually, I think it is a genuine fork in the road this time for different underlying reasons, more to do with party politics and how it works in this country. So it's not so much to do with the kind of the fundamentals of the economy, but it is to do with how we're governed, actually. And I think, clearly for the last 5 years we've lived through this intriguing experiment, as I think another commentator called it, of the first peacetime coalition for 60 years. And I think it's fair to say that it's been proven that it works and can provide stable, strong government, whether you agree with it or not. But we haven't yet embarked on a different sort of experiment, which is to see whether a coalition that's not of two parties could work. And there's a huge question mark over whether it could. And also, because of the Scottish referendum, we're living through this period where we're watching a huge chunk of our territory and a huge chunk of our population ask themselves whether they want to be part of us anymore. And, of course, in the end, the Scots voted no and they voted to stay, probably for those sensible, fundamental economic reasons that Janann would argue are the basis of all politics. But there is something going on there, and clearly the toothpaste's not going back in the tube anytime soon. The referendum is far from settled the issue. the extraordinary thing about this election campaign is the rise of the SNP, who will, you know, may well be the main factor depriving the Labour Party of a majority. And also the knock-on from that could not just sort of be affecting what we do about devolution of power to Scotland and Wales, for example, but is already set in train this enormous question about what we do about how England is governed, even. So actually, I think it is a fork in the road because of these questions of governance and also consent, actually, because people are fed up. I mean, they're deeply, deeply fed up, and maybe some of us have been doing a little bit of on the ground, either reporting or campaigning. And actually, you know, there is a huge gulf now between the governed and the voter, the governors and the governed, the electors and the elected. And so we are going to have to sort of address that as well. So I think there is a big fork in the road, and people have written a lot. I've written about it myself, so has Janine, about this fracturing. You know, that in the 50s, 97% of people either voted for Conservatives or Labour. Now we've got the two parties deadlocked at about 33% each, but we've got the rise of these parties on each extreme, the left and the right. We've got this resurgence of nationalism. It is a kind of picture in flux. And it's going to be really fascinating to see where, you know, how it all resolves itself, because even if some sort of government that can function is cobbled together on after May the 8th, all of these fundamental shifts in the tectonic plates of how our politics works are still going on, and they'll still have to be dealt with. So I think it is actually really quite a moment. Just to talk sort of briefly about the kind of Lib Dem issue. Again, it's to do with sort of boredom as a virtue or otherwise, I suppose. So the Lib Dems were always kind of enjoyed, whatever other people thought of them, they always enjoyed seeing themselves as on the sort of cavalier versus roundhead side, because they were outside the system. And now, because of joining government, they've firmly had to join the roundhead side. You know, the right but revolting in the 1066 and all that description. And, you know, this intriguing experiment of trying to provide stable government through a coalition, okay, they can claim that it's worked, but one thing we've also learned about it is that it is really electorally toxic for the junior party. So they're having to grapple with that, and they're having to try and make a virtue out of being roundheads, not cavaliers, and it sits very, very badly with the sort of people who would traditionally vote Lib Dem, and even with themselves. So it's difficult for them to do. It's difficult for them to convincingly say, you know, vote for us, we're the sensible party, when they quite like to be still be the radical. So there's a kind of nostalgia that they're fighting with there. And I think, you know, if any of you saw Nick Clegg launching his manifesto yesterday, you know, he had to stand there with his manifesto, which is actually a really lovely document with lots of really good policies in it, and say, this is an insurance policy. You know, so Lib Dem doorstep canvassers have literally become self-described door-to-door salesmen for an insurance policy, which is unglamorous in the extreme. And so how they get themselves out of this, their own branding dilemma, you know, which is very different from the Tory branding dilemma, but it is one for them. How they deal with that after the election, whether they're in or out of power, I think is a big issue for the Lib Dems.
Thank you.
Finally, let's hear Tim's opening comments.
Okay, I thought I'd talk a little bit about two possible scenarios, actually. The first one being if Labour makes it into government, and then the second one being if Labour loses. So I'll start with the first scenario, and it's one that actually I quote Janan on in the book, because Janan, I think he'd say, isn't too optimistic about the chances of an effective Labour government. And I'd have to agree with him that it is going to be euphemistically tough if Labour win. I'm not sure, however, that it's going to be catastrophic for a number of reasons. The first is that while we have seen this a little bit from rumblings that have gone over the last 2 weeks, there is clearly still a left in the Labour Party. It's not that big, and I don't think it's any more of a problem than the right in the Conservative Party. In fact, it's probably less of a problem for any Labour Prime Minister. I think there will be some huffing and there will be some puffing, but I doubt very much whether people like John McDonnell or his colleagues will actually blow the House down. If we look at what's happened in previous Labour governments, actually a small majority can often instil a degree of discipline that you don't see when you have a Labour government with a very, very big majority. Harold Wilson was famously caught playing golf in Chequers, I think it was, in the corridors of Chequers by someone, and somebody said, "How's your handicap, Harold?" This was after the 1966 election, which he won very well, and he said, "It's gone up from 4 to 97. And I think there is something to that. And there's something also to the fact that Ed Miliband is not David Cameron, in the sense that I think he is actually quite an emollient people manager, and he might be able to do a slightly better job than David Cameron of making people feel more involved and less neglected. Now, clearly there are going to have to be cuts, and that's going to be a problem for any Social Democratic Party. However, having said that, there are also going to be tax rises. Labour, of course, are not talking about those, and they've agreed to rule out various obvious possibilities. But we know that after almost every single general election, that the government will bring in some kind of revenue-raising measures. I don't know what they're going to be. I mean, at a guess, it might be revaluation of council tax bans, for example. It might be merging national insurance and tax and therefore putting up rates through the back door that way. It might be some sort of hypothecation for NHS funding. But I would say pound to a penny, appositely, there will be tax rises, which means perhaps there will be fewer cuts than perhaps some people think. Clearly, we're also dealing with a bunch of politicians who are not neophytes. Most of the Labour people who will go into government have already been in government. Now, clearly, in much easier times, at least up until 2008, but they do know what it's like to govern. They've also seen the alternative over the last 5 years and haven't liked it very much, which I think may actually instill a degree of discipline. And you can argue that actually, although it's easy to talk about the Brown-Blair years as conflictual, etc., there is a sort of discipline and a professionalism, believe it or not, still around Labour, which is a legacy of the new Labour years. And also that Labour will almost certainly go into government, if they go into government, I think, with the Lib Dems. And the Lib Dem presence provides Labour perhaps with an excuse, perhaps with cover, perhaps with an insurance policy for making some of the cuts that they will need to make. The big problem, obviously, will be the SNP, its anti-austerity agenda. To call that a tricky relationship is an understatement. But the SNP also have to be careful, I think, that they don't destabilise things so much that they seem to bring down a government. So what would social democracy look like in that case? It's very difficult to tell, I think. We haven't really got many available models for what social democracy looks like in hard times. Certainly very successful models. France isn't a good one to look at. Denmark isn't a particularly good one to look at either. In both cases, those parties got realistic and got less popular as a result. I think if we want to look to any examples, it may be Germany, which is, of course, a Christian democratic government, albeit with a social democratic grand coalition element to it. But that wouldn't be that surprising, given Ed's natural affinity, if you like, with a kind of German model of capitalism. I think it was Harold Wilson as well, who said socialism is what a Labour government does. I suspect that social democracy after this election will be what a Labour government does. I think there'll be a degree of inconsistency, there'll be a degree of muddling through, there'll be a degree of what counts is what works. But that's no different from George Osborne and David Cameron, really, if you look at the last 5 years. So that's that scenario. The other scenario is Labour loses. In that case, I think Miliband goes. Even if he makes it through the summer, I would assume there'll be a challenge in the autumn and he would be replaced. And then there's this game about who replaces him. We have the obvious runners and riders. So we have Andy Burnham, who's made a bully pulpit out of the health portfolio over the last few years. We have Yvette Cooper. We have some people in the Labour Party saying to me, oh, well, it has to be a woman this time, so we don't like Yvette, so therefore it'll be Liz Kendall. OK, the sort of tokenism that goes on there, you can imagine. There's also Chuka Umunna, who, of course, tests very well with focus groups, etc. And, you know, there's a degree to which the kind of criticism of him as superficial, etc., I think is overdone. And then there's you know, what I regard as a dark horse, someone like Dan Jarvis, who has big advantages, going back to something that Janan was saying about counterintuitive moves. You know, this is the cleanest of clean skins, if you like. This is someone who clearly does know how to lead people. This is clearly someone who can't be pigeonholed ideologically. This is someone who, you know, to coin the cliche, has a backstory to die for. This is someone who is everything that Ed isn't in some ways and is everything that people don't expect from a Labour leader. So there are other possibilities apart perhaps from the obvious ones. Will that make an ideological difference who wins? I'm not so sure, actually, because while what people do in the campaign to win the leadership obviously constrains what they do afterwards, and that's been true of Ed Miliband, I think, in the way that he tried to distance himself from New Labour and therefore has had difficulty kind of reclaiming some of the achievements of New Labour for Labour as it is now. They don't have to completely constrain what a new leader does. So, for example, if Andy Burnham were to win, we might well get the Andy Burnham that we had during the last Labour government rather than the Andy Burnham that we've had over the last four or 5 years. And anyway, all of them will pay lip service to decentralisation, to fiscal credibility, to unity. I don't think what will happen will be some sort of blue Labour takeover, despite what some people in the House of Lords, in the Labour Party, would like to imagine. I suspect that that won't happen wholesale, nor do I think that the Empire, i.e. New Labour, will strike back in any big way. I think what we'll see is a kind of amalgam, in a best-case scenario, or a fudge in the worst-case scenario, between those two strands. And then the Labour Party is going to have to think, and I'd urge you to think about, really, what policy have they come up with in the last 5 years that has been such a disaster that they need to dump it? What didn't Labour do, or what hasn't Labour done that it needs to do next time around? That's something that we could discuss. If Labour's sensible, then it will just simply try and make a better fist of persuading the public about where it actually is. And where it actually is where it probably was for a lot of the New Labour period, really. It's the ambition to combine kind of economic dynamism with social justice, and it's a tendency to try and get as near to public opinion on issues like immigration and law and order as it's possible for a kind of progressive liberal party to get. Clearly, one thing Labour will have to do is rebuild its relationship, at least at the rhetorical level, with business. That's going to be, I think, a big ask for the next Labour leader. And what Labour should do is focus its attack on the next Conservative government, if there is one, not on its cruelty, as it seemed to do for so much of the last 5 years, but on its competence. And there's a big kind of missing chunk, I think, of the Labour Party's job in opposition that it hasn't done that well, and it could do much better next time around. And then it also has to decide what it does about Scotland. Is it serious in thinking that, you know, this is a blip, it can come back to somewhere near what it managed to get, you know, for most of the 20th century? Or should it actually in some ways kind of give up on Scotland? Or is there some sort of midway point between those two? What I think it shouldn't do, what I think it shouldn't do is see the whole thing as an existential crisis for social democracy, because I think social democracy in the 21st century is pretty hard to define anyway. And it'd be very, very important then not to make it a crisis, or indeed to make a drama out of that crisis. The other thing that the Labour Party is going to have to come to terms with, and it's something that the Tories are going to have to come to terms with, something that the Liberal Democrats are very familiar with, I'm not sure we're ever going to get back to a politics where the Labour Party, like the Conservative Party, is going to be able to get over 40% again. And it's how these two big parties adjust to that I think will be the most interesting thing. Okay. A
OK, lots of wise counsel in there from all three. I want to go back to this notion of brand, because we've had three manifestos come out in the last few days, and it seems to me that all of them were an exercise in addressing brand weakness. The Lib Dems from lack of trust to trust, and it's a very impressive and detailed document. The Tories from sort of cruelty to compassion, if not with a bit of aspiration mixed in as well. And Labour from irresponsibility to fiscal responsibility. It'd be good to get your take on the manifestos and how credible it is at this stage to be addressing these brand weaknesses, and why on earth, by all three parties, this wasn't done earlier. Let's start off with Miranda.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point why this wasn't done earlier. I mean, my own feeling is it probably is a bit too late for all three of them, actually, to recover that territory, which is why this week, you know, we've had so much commentary about, political cross-dressing. Because that's what it seems like. If you spend 5 years saying we're the party of fiscal rectitude on one side and we're the party of compassion on the other, and then you then decide 24 days before polling day to do that, everyone knows it's just not very convincing. But what's really interesting is if you look at how this relates to what's going on the ground, for example. So the Tory decision to come out and say Jeremy Hunt, and then a few days later, much more dramatically, David Cameron, we will give the £8 billion demanded in the Simon Stevens plan for the NHS. It's not in the Tory leaflets on the ground. And it takes a long time to order leaflets and print them and get them out there. So there's a slight suspicion, not wanting to sort of veer too much towards advocacy, as we've been warned. But, you know, there is a slight suspicion that that was some sort of ad hoc decision. And it's a big ad hoc decision to be taking in terms of a spending commitment, you know. So it is questionable, you know, whether it's a proper transformation. And I think also in the case of the Tory party, so much effort in the early Cameron years was put into this detoxification strategy, and was just all sort of let go. I think that's very difficult for them. In terms of the Lib Dem trust issue and the brand, it's basically a disaster because. The problem that they've got, and they're doing quite a sort of good job of it, I think, in bad circumstances, is to get anybody to listen to them on anything, that person who's listening has to have got over their initial problem of trust. And so you could have the best manifesto in the world and the best set of policies in the world, but if that voter has just switched off from what you're saying, You're not going to sell your political product. So it's really, really, really difficult. And clearly, you know, with Nick Clegg making his to camera apology about tuition fees, they were trying to sort of take that issue on the chin. And actually, I thought in the first sort of seven-way leaders debate, he made quite a good fist of taking that on direct as well. But it's a huge problem for a lot of voters, whether or not they're directly affected by the policy as it emerged. Which, as we all know, was quite sensible and has resulted in more disadvantaged kids going to university. But, I just don't think they're going to get over that. And that's why the Lib Dem campaign is a ground war, fighting individual seats in terms of a tactical vote to maximise presence next time, to have any sort of leverage over a future government.
This is the one only time I'm going to quote Linton Crosby, but his "you can't fatten a pig on market day" kind of is after these circumstances in a particular sort of Australian vernacular, but, you know, I think it's probably got some truth in it.
Can I just add one thing on that, though? What I think the Lib Dems have done, which is the right thing that they also should have done 2 years ago, is they've finally decided to talk proudly about what they've done in government and what their record actually is and what difference they've made. If they'd been doing that in a full-throated way for the last 3 years, instead of this, in my view, slightly disastrous differentiation strategy, as it was called, then I think they'd be in a better position now, actually. But that's a very controversial thing to say, and there are many people who disagree.
And Labour had exactly the same issue in 2010 in how it actually could contend with its own record, particularly the economic record towards the latter years in government, and decided essentially to duck it, for what I can observe.
Yeah, I mean, they should have paid more attention to you, actually, Anthony, in some ways, because you wrote a very good pamphlet on this called In the Black Labour, which I would still recommend to people, actually. It's a very insightful document. I think, to be fair, Labour had a problem in part because they had Ed Ball as a shadow chancellor, who had an intellectual critique of what the government was doing, which made it very difficult, I think, for Labour really to focus on its own fiscal credibility. So convinced was he that what the government was doing was going to choke off recovery that he concentrated all his fire and all his effort on that sort of intellectual critique, rather than thinking actually about the kind of political strategy, which I think would have been to talk about fiscal responsibility much earlier than he did. I think Ball's always intended to do what he did, but he also went back to his sort of 1997 playbook and remembered that actually Labour kind of announced that it wasn't going to raise taxes, actually quite near to the election. And I think, you know, going back to Jonathan's point about counterintuitive stuff, I think he felt that that would play better the nearer they were to do it to the election. And I think that was a mistake. But if you look at Labour, actually, the whole thing about fiscal credibility has been going on for at least a year now. It's just been diluted, I think, in part by Labour's poor messaging. And whatever you think of the Labour Party under Ed Miliband, its media operation and its messaging operation isn't as strong as it might be. And so while Labour has actually been talking for quite a long time now about fiscal responsibility, you almost wouldn't know it, because they very often talk about it and then move on to something else. Or they'll talk about it and make an announcement at the same time. So the key example of this is when Ed Balls announced that they weren't going to spend any more than the Conservatives. They were going to stick to the Conservative spending targets. He did it at the same time as talking about the 50p tax rate. So, of course, all the headlines were about the 50p tax rate, and they weren't about the much more important strategic move, which was to stick to Conservative spending plans. So I don't think it's a complete turnaround on Labour's part, but because they haven't got the messaging right, it looks like one. And as Miranda says, it's a little bit too late, I think, for that.
And I think, you know, similar in 2005 with the Conservative, they smelt the coffee, and, you know, to quote Lord Ashcroft's book of the time, and then they turned away from it, and they've never quite had the confidence to turn back.
Yeah, I mean, there is this thing called the crash, and I think had it not been for that, then the trajectory was fairly sound. I remember the summer of 2008, they hit 50 points in an ICM poll or a Comres or something, and they were 20 points ahead of Labour, and it was peak modernisation phase. And then the crash happened. And their excuse is always, look, once the crash happens and there's a fiscal crisis, and you know that the subsequent government, post-2010, is going to be dominated by fiscal consolidation, raising taxes, cutting spending, modernisation automatically, with all the best will in the world, dies. Yes. How can a Conservative government come across as big-hearted when it's doing that? Necessarily doing that. To which my response is always, well, what a lack of imagination. Yeah. You know, they're still within that frame, there's still distributional choices you could make. And the party could have said, and here's another, you know, I mentioned IHT earlier on, but what if the party had said in 2009, massive budget deficit, we're going to have to raise taxes as well as cut spending. If your house is worth over £2 million, we're going to levy a mansion tax, yes. Which they almost did in 2011-12 in the budgets, and then they sort of balked on it in the end. But something like that, you know, to this day, in focus groups, if you ask people in a focus group to draw a picture which represents the parties, for Labour it's a guy on a couch on benefits. For the Tories, it's, I'm not endorsing these, but these are just what people draw. For the Tories, it's a smug family outside a massive house. They're associated with entrenched wealth, especially property wealth, people who are already heavily advantaged in life. Had they come up with something like that back in 2009, saying we're going to ask more from these people, and by the way, some of the proceeds will be spent on a tax cut for someone earning the 20% rate of income tax. That's how you do it. A perfunctory gesture 4 weeks before election day in a manifesto that no one will read, and which is contradicted by other things you're saying at the same time, won't move anything. And I think you alluded to the smell the coffee period and the early Cameron days when he went to Norway or Iceland and did the whole husky thing. It's easy to mock, and it's inherently sort of comical, but it didn't fail. And the average person in the street, I think, would think, you know, one of the I'm fascinated to read the Ashcroft focus group quotes, because some of them are funny and some of them are insightful. And people often say of Cameron, I think he's done an okay job and he doesn't seem like a typical Tory. Now, everything he's done in government has been fairly typically Tory. I think he's still living off the fact that when he first came to public attention in January 2006, and he has that six-week period to make an immediate impression, which all new leaders have, he used it quite wisely to do stuff which we might regard as a bit frou-frou and metropolitan, but it was not what you expect a Tory to do, the environmental stuff, etc. It almost does it. I have this argument with Tories sometimes where they say, well, what the public want is actually someone who talks about economic stuff and inequality, and they see us as the party of the rich, so the environment stuff was kind of irrelevant. And I get that. But the brand was so bad, and is so bad, that all he had to do was come across as something other than the brand, almost regardless of what it was. And he chose to do the environmental stuff because it's quite easy to capture in an image. And I think it did work, and it's much more successful than... And this is a tough thing to say at the RSA because you're all about policy and the heavy lifting intellectually, but that cheap stunt is worth far more. That cheap stunt, symbolic PR stunt in 2006 on the iceberg or glacier, was worth far more than anything they can say policy-wise now before the election campaign.
Yeah, so part of Cameron's problem was he regarded that kind of thing as a cheap stunt and would never do that himself. Absolutely, he should have had his own version of that. I mean, it was a problem partly because he, unlike Cameron, he didn't know he was going to win before he won, so he didn't have that amount of time to prepare what he wanted to do, so the first 100 days were chaotic, really. But I absolutely agree. There's no attempt to sort of produce images that would cut through and make him look different from what he is, in the same way that Cameron is a traditional Tory, which is the kind of North London intellectual Labour Party leader.
His own images, yes. Effectively. I think this point about politicos reading opinion polls very closely but missing the big picture, I think, is a very, very good one, actually. And you just see all the dialogue around this, and you get this sense that they're missing something else that you can't pick up in either qualitative or quantitative survey. I think what we're going to do now is we're going to open out to the audience. I know people have been itching with questions, so I'm going to go with the lady in the centre here.
Nobody's mentioned UKIP. One simple question. Do you think they'll hang on to the two seats where Tory MPs defected, and do you think they'll win any more, and if so, where?
Daniel Cremin. I'm really interested in this point about brand. I think it's really important. I think it comes out as the third stool, actually, alongside the actual the context of competence and leadership and the economy. The thing that really interests me about you, Tim, is that you talked earlier about Labour having the greybeards still in place, people who'd actually been in government before. I think back in 2011 you could have said that about Labour. You had Alan Johnson for the first few months as Shadow Chancellor. By about December, January, he'd gone. John Denham left. The point is that you talk about Labour being in that position of still having the competence thing. Hasn't Labour actually... You talk about the left as well. John McDonnell is not the left. Ed Miliband, in many respects, is the left. They genuinely see themselves as a break from New Labour, and that there's an opportunity there. In a post-election landscape, if they have to work with the Lib Dems, there is actually, if you have John Cruddas rather than Liam Byrne doing a manifesto, you're being inspirational. You're not
okay,
necessarily...
I'm going to have to... Okay, thank you. I'm this gentleman here.
Can I take an opposite? Doesn't the emphasis on brand show poverty of the political discourse nowadays,
good,
where... You don't really know whether any of the parties actually believe in some core set of beliefs which follow through into policy. And that is reflected in the low turnout and the widespread cynicism among the electorate, especially after the expenses scandal.
Great, thank you. Miranda, can you take this point about the Labour Party's brand as being, you know, far further left than it is, and how that might make a relationship with Liberal Democrats more difficult than it might have been 5 years ago, for argument's sake, or even 10 years ago?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question, because Ed Miliband has said confidently, Britain has moved to the left. And we really don't know whether that's right or not, do we? You know, so he has positioned himself in a very different place from New Labour. I mean, I hear everything that Tim said about continuity, New Labour under a different guise. But I'm not sure about that, actually. And also, you know, Tim's point about how Ed Miliband should have made some big gesture, counterintuitive gesture. I think that's a really interesting question, because I don't think it's just that he despises the gestures. I think it would be totally inauthentic, because he is quite left-wing. Do you know what I mean? So you know, for instance, in the first leaders to... You know, the Paxman head-to-head and then questions from the audience, that one. a woman asked a question of Ed Miliband and said, you know, I've worked really hard, I want to get on, why do I feel that you're not on my side? And he didn't, he should have said, good for you, congratulations, you know, and I am on your side. And he couldn't, he didn't say it because that's possibly not what he thinks, you know. So I think this is actually a really interesting question. And in terms of the Liblabbery, I actually think that, I mean, some of the papers have done it this morning. I think there's quite a lot of overlap. I think there's lots of things they could do together. I think it's quite a healthy prospect of something quite sensible if they have the numbers and if they can make it work. But you're right. In terms of, you know, that old-fashioned word ideology and philosophy, there is quite a big difference between Labour and the Lib Dems. It's not just kind of two branches of the same centre-left family. It's different traditions. And I think that's more visible now than it ever was in the new Labour years, as branded.
Thank you. And, Tim, I'd like you to take on this sort of UKIP question, if that's OK. Is support for UKIP deflating as it might appear to be? But then what's the sort of medium-term threat? Is it more to the Conservatives or to Labour? Is there a future coming together of the Conservatives and UKIP, for example, that might harm Labour?
I mean, I think in answer to the specific question, I would expect they'll probably save those two seats and possibly Nigel Farage may win in Thanet. I find it difficult to see that they'll win many other seats. If they get, you know, four or five, I think they'll be doing quite well. I mean, the bizarre thing about this election is that Labour needs UKIP to do quite well. I mean, Labour really needs UKIP to be scoring around 10%. That's the sweet spot where it's not really going to eat into the Labour vote very much, but it'll eat into enough of the Conservative vote to deny the Conservatives some Labour-Tory marginals. A lot has been written by political scientists, obviously, Rob and Matt, Goodwin and Ford, about the threat that UKIP poses in the long term to Labour. I'm a little bit more sceptical about how much of that threat in the end will do Labour damage in parliamentary seats, even in the long term, partly because I am not entirely sure that UKIP is a long term threat, at least as it currently is. If you look at UKIP's support, it is very demographically skewed. It's not like populist parties in other parts of Europe who seem to be able to attract quite a young electorate and even on occasion some women as well. If you look at the UKIP electorate, it is, as some political scientists have called it, it's grumpy old men. And although it's quite heretical to say it, because we always want to think of populism as this sort of rising force that we must take account of, there is the possibility that it's simply a kind of waiting game, this. That really, you know, it's sort of a 10, 20-year phenomenon that will eventually begin to dissipate, at least in its current form, simply because there aren't enough takers in the younger generation for that kind of politics. So I don't think Labour should be completely complacent and perhaps shouldn't buy into that heretical view completely. But I think there's something to be said for that. I think in terms of UKIP's effect on the Conservatives, perhaps Janan can talk a little bit more about that. I think that has been one of the big problems. I mean, Janan said the crash happened, but as he'll probably go on to say, I mean, UKIP happened as well. And to the extent that David Cameron has been blown off course, I think UKIP has had something to do with that, or at least the need for David Cameron to respond to backbenchers who think that UKIP must be dealt with and responded to.
John, if you could pick up that point about UKIP and the Conservatives, but also, given you brought brand into the conversation, this point about the poverty of political discourse and the notion of political brand.
Yeah, just quickly on UKIP, I think UKIP, one of UKIP's achievements was to drive the Conservative Party insane for about 2 years. I mean, between 2011, 2013, the party became unhinged by the threat of being outflanked on the right. And they would throw anything at trying to stop it, and some of it stuck. The Europe referendum commitment, in retrospect, was reasonably successful, at least at pacifying the Conservative Party, some of whom were tempted by UKIP. But for 2 years, they really went off on one, and it's taken them a while to realise it was unproductive in terms of winning back UKIP voters, and B, actively counterproductive in terms of hanging on to centrist voters. So I think the Conservatives have moderated over the past year or so and been less fixated with chasing UKIP, and they're kind of resigned to UKIP getting 10%, actually, is what the number one person quoted to me, that they think UKIP are going to do that much, and there's not much the Tories can do to influence that. So that's the serial achievement of UKIP, sort of making Cameron lose it, I think, for the middle of this parliament. But on the question about brand versus... It's sort of brand versus ideological commitment. And I always get this sense that people blame disillusion in politics on whatever they themselves are already angry about, right? So if and one of the, you know, of course, you know, they'll watch PMQs and say, oh, this is awful, this is why people are disillusioned with politics, the Punch and Judy stuff. And you think, possibly, but give me one data point that proves that. And in this case, it's people are disillusioned with politics because the ideological choices have watered down over my lifetime, really. And the party manifestos are pretty similar, and it's all presentation, and there aren't these big red-blue choices anymore. And that, I'm open to that being true. I just don't know why we're so certain that that's true. And you know, all the circumstantial evidence of my lifetime is that when you offer people a big ideological choice, you scare people. Yes. And in 1992, it wasn't even a seismic choice. It was, you know, I think John Smith was committed to raising a standard rate of income tax a bit. So if you're earning 30 grand a year or something, you'd be paying a tiny bit more income tax. And you saw what the reaction was. And that was a choice election. So I think that the surest way to lose an election and to alienate a lot of wavering voters is almost to neglect brand and try and stake out a very clear and distinctive intellectual position. I mean, that seems to be the sort of evidence of my experience of politics.
Let's take another round of questions. I'm going to go to this lady here, this gentleman here, and I'm going to go to that gentleman at the back there.
Sorry, it's another question about branding. Sorry. Miranda, you talked about the Lib Dems and how lack of trust was their biggest issue. How long do you think it will take for the Lib Dems to rebuild their trust and hopefully gain more of the popular vote in upcoming elections?
Okay.
Yes, the public notoriously don't like splits, and yet we love commentating on them. So my question is, if Labour wins, will the sort of personal differences between Miliband and Balls and Cooper remain sort of masked? If the Conservatives win, will Cameron keep the party together over the EU referendum? And regardless, will the Libs keep together in terms of the right-leaning Libs, Liberal Democrats and the left-leaning ones?
Great, thank you.
If there is another coalition, does this not prove that the people want a proportional representation as a way of voting, and that this first-past-the-post system, which we've had for many years, which is so anti-democracy, it's untrue, that we can have something more based on what we have here in London, based on the popular impression on that? Do you agree with that? And that first-past-the-post is...
It's fine to advocate electoral systems, by the way. It's just political political parties. Tim, I was going to ask a question about it, because Miranda brought up governance earlier on, and everyone seems pretty miserable with the current way in which we're governed, but they don't seem convinced by any of the alternatives. Is that a fair...?
Yeah, I mean, on the electoral reform question, I mean, I would be a little bit more hopeful if I were in your position if we hadn't had the AV referendum, which was on a system which wasn't actually proportional, but unfortunately it can be used by... the opponents of electoral reform to suggest that the question's been asked, it's been settled fairly convincingly one way. Yeah, I have to, you know, I out myself and say I hope you're right. And it could be that, you know, we have a number of elections that force the issue back onto the agenda, but I'm not sure just one election will do it. But, I mean, clearly if we have the case where, you know, the SNP come back with 50 MPs but get a much smaller share of the vote nationally than UKIP, who come back with just three MPs, then it could be there's some momentum behind that. I mean, I think unfortunately it won't happen till the Conservative Party realises that it's in its best interests. And I do actually feel now, if I were a Conservative, I would reevaluate the electoral system, because at the moment, because of the split on the right, and it's something that some Tories are completely obsessed with, they have a situation in which UKIP could pick up, you know, at election after election, 10% of the vote. This is if they do carry on, contrary to my previous point. And yet, those votes are useless to the Conservatives because they don't result in MPs who they can do a deal with in Parliament on confidence and supply or even coalition, as other centre-right parties in Europe are able to do with populist parties. So if there's any one party that's got an interest in electoral reform, arguably now, it's the Conservatives. But whether they actually can realise that is another matter. Just very briefly on a couple of the other ones. On the split, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. Even the way you phrased it, I think, indicates something that is probably true, which is that the splits in the Labour Party, in as much as they exist, are not so ideological as just personal and frictional in that sense, whereas the splits in the Conservative Party and possibly the Liberal Democrats actually have something more underlying and ideological about them. Now, whether that makes them better or worse is another question, because we've seen under the new Labour government, you know, how bad personal splits can be.
That's interesting. So Miranda, do you buy that the Lib Dems are sort of split around sort of values and different approaches to liberalism? And then picking up this point about then, what is the trajectory back to?
Well, I think they're two of very much linked, are linked around the question of what happens after May the 8th. Conveniently for our discussion. I don't think the Lib Dems are very split, actually. And I think this can be overplayed by going back to the history of the party and the SDPers and the Liberals and blah, blah, blah. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, I think that's sort of c'est du passé. And if you look at the sort of newer Lib Dems, it's much younger, it's much more diverse. And they probably wouldn't even understand the conversation about the SDP versus the Liberals, you know. So I think that can be overplayed. However, and this is absolutely crucial, if the Lib Dems are faced with some sort of situation after the election where it's unclear who of the two large parties has the sort of moral right to be seen as the winner, that is a nightmare for the Lib Dems, you know, because that involves some sort of genuine kingmaker choice rather than, you can't say anything about the 2010 election, in my view, apart from the fact that Gordon Brown lost it, you know. And so therefore, even though it was completely counterintuitive for the Liberals to form a coalition for the Tory party, it was a big shock, lots of votes, etc., you know, if you look at what the election was about, you know, we might not have that sort of clarity this time. And therefore, the Lib Dems have got to go through this democratic process of, you know, not just negotiating a coalition and putting it to the various bits of the party, holding a special conference, etc. That worked very well this time over the last 5 years of keeping the party unified, keeping all the MPs on board. There were very, very few parliamentary rebellions by Lib Dem MPs, for example, during the coalition years. Whether you'd be able to pull it off a second time is questionable, because you may well get some Lib Dem MPs feeling very strongly drawn to a Labour coalition and others the other way. And I think that also plays into this question about trust, because the nightmare really for the Lib Dems is, you know, it's the terrible penalty of success of being asked to take part in government for the first time in decades and the electoral price you pay for it. If you are in that situation again, and as a party you feel the right thing to do is to go with the Conservatives, then you really have said goodbye to a chunk of people on the centre-left. If the numbers fall a different way and you form some sort of agreement with the Labour Party, then you may be saying goodbye to another bunch of centrist voters on the other side of that central sort of philosophical fulcrum. And that's quite tricky, you know, because you then might be seen as sort of flighty in some way. You know, I don't know why the smaller party in a coalition is always feminised in this way. It seems to me rather insulting to the female population. But that, you know, so I think that's an issue as well.
Great, thank you. And of course, this moral authority, this is all based on a fundamental constitutional principle that you go with the largest party with a large number of votes that Nick Clegg invented in 2010. So it's kind of become a bit boxed in, hasn't it? Yeah. Janine, where are the major fault lines within the major parties in the next parliament?
I think a conservative split over Europe is almost nailed on, actually. I mean, a third of the parliamentary party would vote to leave in most circumstances. I think there's a more interesting additional third whose position is we will vote to stay if we achieve such and such a renegotiation. And the renegotiation they set out is implausible, in my view. So they're sort of de facto out, if you see what I mean. You follow the chain of events and they end up being out. So I think the Conservatives are headed for something like, it could be a Corn Laws, Robert Peel style, mid-19th century existential split in the run-up to a European referendum campaign. Beyond Europe, I no longer buy the idea that the Conservative Party is massively split on ideology, or at least more split than it has been at any time in the past. It's a fairly, you know, each intake of Tories is more and more free market, which may be a problem when it comes to winning elections, but in terms of internal coherence, they're basically free market, generally socially more and more liberal as a parliamentary party. But on Europe, there are massive differences. But the question of splits is connected to the question of the voting system, because, you know, a lot of us would agree that the three main parties, as they currently are configured, don't make much sense anymore, in that they contain massive differences, and there are people in each party who have more in common with some people in other parties. And yet, first past the post preserves the system in aspic. It's very difficult for a change in the party arrangements to happen under this voting system. So were there to be a voting change, and I doubt there will be, precisely because we had a referendum so recently, then you could see a reconfiguration of the parties on really interesting lines. So, you know, the point I always make is Joe Johnson is in the same party as Jacob Rees-Mogg, yes, and yet Joe Johnson and Tristram Hunt and David Laws are in separate parties. That cannot be rational. And if you were designing a system from scratch, you'd have a what you'd call it a kind of economist FT party or whatever. And they'd win about, I don't know, 10% of the vote, if that. But
they'd be happy.
Exactly. And in a proportional system, they could be quite a decisive force. But nothing changes, I think, while we have the existing voting arrangements.
Great. Okay, we're going to finish off with a bit of fun now for both the panel and the audience. So I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to all answer as honestly as you possibly can. And Janan mentioned in 1992, if this event had happened, people's predictions would have been made and it would have been on video and it would have been used against them 20 years later. But the question is this. In the middle of June 2015, who is going to be Prime Minister and who is going to be Deputy Prime Minister? Tim.
I've suddenly gone deaf. I was. Well, listen, what I will say is that he says like a politician. If the question you're asking me is, if the Conservatives can't get 290 seats on May the 8th, they're not going to be in government. Okay, so that I think is the number that everyone has to look for. And if that's the case, and I think we will then get a government with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister, with Nick Clegg, if he survives in Sheffield Hallam, as Deputy Prime Minister. It'll be a minority Labour-Liberal coalition backed by the SNP.
Miranda.
Oh, dear.
The panellists, but...
Well, I'll give you an answer, but it doesn't actually have much conviction behind it, because I genuinely think it's impossible. But... I think that David Cameron will still be Prime Minister. And I think the Deputy Prime Minister might be somebody unexpected and female, perhaps, but from within the Tory party.
Thank you. Janan, minority Tory government. Yeah. Cameron Clegg.
Status quo.
I don't think my gut. Whatever I know, the data is plentiful and says different things, and but when the data is ambiguous, I tend to go with gut and conversations with non-political mates. Yes. And the vibe I get is that this is not a massive. This is more of a continuity election than a change election. Yeah. And inferring from that, I would say what we've had for the past 5 years might last for at least another 2 years.
Can I just add to that? I actually agree with that. It's just that the numbers, the numbers might not stack up to support that. But
I would agree with it if it wasn't for the fact that this time round David Cameron's going to have to ask the Tory party about what he wants to do, which he didn't have to do last time.
Indeed. Okay. I'll play as well, just to be fair. I think as things stand, if there is not some unforeseen massive change, which there might be, that we haven't either seen yet, or might occur later on in the day, I think
that the Prime Minister is going to be Ed Miliband and the Deputy Prime Minister is going to be Harriet Harman, and they're going to have a very, very difficult set of relationships with the SNP in particular, but probably easier with the Liberal Democrats. So there we are. Now I want the audience to play, but I'm not going to go through all the potential Deputy Prime Minister candidates. So there's two options here. I want you to put your hand up to begin with if you think Ed Miliband is going to be Prime Minister. Hold on. And the second question will be if you think that David Cameron is going to be Prime Minister. So who thinks Ed Miliband is going to be Prime Minister in the middle of June?
Well, that's good for sales.
For the audience at home, I'd say about a quarter of the audience think Ed Miliband's going to be Prime Minister. David Cameron? I would say about half. And so I think there's some abstentions in the audience as well. So, marginally, the RSA audience today has it for David Cameron on a predictive basis. OK, thank you very much. I thought that was great. And thank you all for participating. I hope you enjoyed it. So, an applause for our guests, please.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.